Okay, tonight I'd like to pick up where we had left off, and we left off actually in the second book of Kings. We left off in chapter 15. And we do have some new people here tonight, so just let me give you an overview real quick of what we're going through as we're going through this book of Kings. Just for clarification, and I'm not going to get into too much detail here, but I want to just clarify this in your mind, because when we're going through this book, it can get really confusing, and people can get really lost, because we're talking about one king in the north and one king in the south. The king in the north is referred to as the king of Israel, and the king in the south is referred to as the king of Judah. But just in a brief background, when Israel first became a nation, and then they had their king, their very first king was Saul, and of course he blew it, and then David took his place as king. And then after David, there was Solomon. And then Solomon, he blew it. He had 700 wives, 300 concubines, and they led his heart astray, and he began to worship these false gods, the gods of Chemosh and Moloch and all these other false deities. And God was very angry with him. So because of his idolatry, God just split the kingdom. He said, I'm going to split it in half, but for the sake of my servant David, I'm going to leave you the southern portion. Anyway, so after Solomon, you had a split kingdom. Solomon's son, his first son was Rehoboam, and then the northern kingdom, which their capital was referred to as Samaria, and the southern kingdom, it was Jerusalem. Well, in the northern kingdom, you had Jeroboam the first, all right? And so he set up a kingdom up there when it split. But Jeroboam the first, what he did, he told all the people that in this northern kingdom here, he said, look, you don't have to go down to Jerusalem three times a year the way the Mosaic law required. You don't have to go down there anymore because it's too much of a long trek for you. So he just, what he told them, he said, I'm going to set up a golden calf up here in Dan, and I'm going to set up a golden calf down here in Bethel. And he says it's going to be very, very convenient for you to, rather than going all the way down to Jerusalem, you can just go there and worship the God of heaven. Now, when he set up these golden calf, he was telling everybody, this is the God of heaven. It wasn't like they were setting up some kind of totem pole and then they were bowing down to worship an idol. They just said this was a representation of God of heaven. And it was a real affront to God for doing that, because the reason, his motivation for doing that was that he didn't want the people going down there to Jerusalem three times a year the way the Mosaic law required, because if they did that, he was afraid that the people would eventually say, hey, man, you know, we don't need this Rehoboam guy. We don't need to be split into two kingdoms. We're just going to, you know, become one kingdom. And he was afraid he'd be assassinated. But rather than trusting God, he just devised his whole scheme. And in God's eyes, it was an evil thing that he did. And every single king that followed him in the northern kingdom went right along with that. And God judged him for that time and time again. But then in the southern kingdom, you have all these kings on this side. You got from Rehoboam all the way down to Zedekiah, which is the last king in Judah, you got 20 kings. And of those 20 kings, you've only got about 8 of them that God considered were good. And even those 8, some of them were, you know, started out really good, and then they ended up shipwrecked. And that, to me, is very instructive. And then, of course, you've got 20 guys on the Northern Kingdom, and not one of them was any good as far as God is concerned. And I think that's very instructive to us, because, you know, God evaluates each and every one of our lives on a basis of whether we're going to obey him or not. And that's the way this story picks up. Now we're picking up in this chapter 15. We're going to be dealing with a king in Judah. His name is Azariah, and some of your Bibles may say Uzziah. And I think what he does is very, very instructive too, because beginning with that verse 1 in chapter 15, it says, in the 27th year of Jeroboam, the king of Israel, Azariah, the son of Amaziah, king of Judah, became king. And he was 16 years old when he became king, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jecoliah of Jerusalem. He did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. Only the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense in the high places. The Lord struck the king so that he was a leper to the day of his death, and he lived in a separate house while Jotham, the king's son, was over the household judging the people of the land. Now, the rest of the acts of Azariah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And Azariah slept with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Jotham, his son, became king in his place. Now, this is only 7 verses, but what we really need to do, we need to read the account in Chronicles. Chronicles chapter 26, if you can, turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 26, okay? And while you're turning there, I just want to comment on this, especially for the people who haven't been here before, on that verse 4 in chapter 15 where it says, only the high places were not taken away, the people still did sacrifice and burned incense on the high places. Understand this too, because this was very important. What the people were doing is that they wanted a sacrifice to the one true God, and so they go to these high places. The high places could be a hill, it could be a mountain, it could be any kind of elevated platform, and they would go there and they would sacrifice to God. But God had really forbidden that. If you go to Deuteronomy chapter 12, and don't even try to find it. This is what God said. Chapter 12 in Deuteronomy. It says, God says this, when you get into the land of the Canaanites, God had told them, he says, you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and burn their ashrams with fire, and you shall cut down the engraven images of their gods and obliterate their name from that place. You shall not act like this towards the Lord your God, but you shall seek the Lord at the place, now this is important, you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose from all of your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, there you shall come. And it says it over and over again in chapter 12 of Deuteronomy, that God has specifically said, I'm going to choose a specific place. That's the only place I want you to offer sacrifices to me. That's what God said. And I don't want to digress here, but I'm telling you right now, this is one of the reasons why the Jews today, they want so desperately to get their temple up. But at their temple site, the ancient temple site, is the Mosque of Omar. That's where the Solomon's temple was. That's the place that God chose. That's the place I want you to offer sacrifices and to worship me. So they're in a bind here. They don't know what to do. They would have had this temple up years ago, except that they don't know what to do with this mosque. It's very, very, they believe strongly that either that mosque is going to be destroyed through war or through natural disasters, and they're going to get their temple up. I'm kind of all over the board here, but I want to just explain this, because when people read this, they say, well, what's the high places? What's the high places all about? I don't care what the high places is, because it seems like God's making a big issue about these high places. Well, what happened was that God forbade the people to worship him on these every little hill or mountain or any place that they would choose. And the reason he did that is because he knew that it was just over a period of time that they would begin to inculcate the pagan rituals and beliefs and ceremonies, and sure enough, that's exactly what they did. But God tolerated it. Even Solomon offered up the thousands of sacrifices up in Gibeah on the high place, you know, before the temple was erected. And God just basically tolerated that for some time. But, you know, what this points to in the New Testament is what Paul talks about when he talks about in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 11. He says, I am afraid that just as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your minds should be led astray by the simplicity, the purity, the devotion to Christ. Now listen to this. For if one comes and preaches another Jesus whom you have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully. And then he goes on and tells them in Galatians. See, Galatians chapter 1. He said to them, I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another gospel, only there are some of you who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we have preached to you, he is to be accursed. As we have said before, so I am saying again, now, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you have received, he is to be accursed. Now, what we see today is the same thing. How many people today have a different gospel, have a different Christ? There's people even within the Christian church today, they have a different Christ. There's a sensual Christ. They feel like, well, you know, God made me the way that I am as far as my sexual proclivities or whatever, and they want God to bless whatever lifestyle that they choose. And that's a different gospel. That's a different Christ. Or you've got people who just want Jesus Christ as some kind of cuddly mascot that's just kind of there, you know, when they need somebody to answer their prayers, like some celestial Santa Claus or butler or whatever. There's all kinds of different Christs. Well, this is what I'm saying. We're dealing with the Old Testament now before Jesus came, but what happens is that people start worshiping God any way that they want to worship God, and they start believing in God the way they want to believe it. And when we start doing that, it always ends up in heresy. And the reason I've gone through all that before we even get into Uzziah here is because you've got to understand where God is coming from. Because when we're going through the Second Kings, we just keep reading it over and over and over and over again about the high places and about the sins of Jeroboam, who set up these golden calves in Dan and Bethel. But what I want to do is, if you turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 26, we got to get a better picture of this Uzziah, because this guy started out really well. He reigned for something like 52 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. He became king at 16. He apparently had a very godly mother, and he really was sold out to the Lord. But look what happens to this guy, because to me, this is a very instructive. Look at that, chapter 26, beginning with verse 1. And then all the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16 years old, and they made him king in the place of his father Amaziah. And he built Eloth and restored it to Judah after the king slept with his fathers. Uzziah was 16 years old when he became king, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jechiliah of Jerusalem. He did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. He continued to seek God in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding through the vision of God, and as long as he sought the Lord, God prospered him. Now look at that. That is, to me, is very, very instructive, because he says as long as he sought the Lord, what did God do? God prospered him. This is something you see over and over again, I think, in the Old Testament. I mean, for example, in Joshua chapter 1, God told Joshua this. He said, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you to do, and do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. That's the key to success. That's the key to being prosperous, is what? Obeying God, following God, loving God, seeking God. That's the key to success. But look at this Uzziah. He, as long as he was, you know, seeking God and following God and obeying God, God was prospering him, and everything he did, God was blessing. Because look at that verse 6 in that chapter 26 of 2 Chronicles. He said, now he went out and warred against the Philistines and broke down the wall of Gath and the wall of the Jabneth and the wall of Ashdod, and he built cities in the area of Ashdod and among the Philistines. God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabians who lived in Gurbaal and the Midianites. The Ammonites also gave tribute to Uzziah, and his fame extended to the border of Egypt, and he became very strong. Moreover, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and the valley gate and at the corner buttress and fortified them. He built towers in the wilderness and hewn many cisterns, for he had much livestock both in the lowlands and in the plains. He also had plowmen and vine dressers in the hill country and in the fertile fields, and he loved the soil. Moreover, Uzziah had an army ready for battle, which entered combat by divisions according to the number of their muster, prepared by Jael the scribe and Messiah, the official, under the direction of Haniah, one of the king's officers. The total number of the heads of the households of valiant warriors was 2,600. Under their direction was an elite army of 307,500 who could wage war with great power to help the king against the enemy. Moreover, Uzziah prepared all the army shields and spears and helmets and body armor, bows and sling stones. In Jerusalem, he made engines of war invented by skillful men to be on the towers and on the corners for the purpose of shooting arrows and great stones. Hence his fame spread afar, for he was marvelously helped until he was strong. Now, you know, I think the Holy Spirit went to great lengths here to basically itemize all this guy's achievements and the things that he was able to accomplish. I mean, God gave him victory over his enemies left and right. And, you know, this man was very, very diligent. And he was very, very, I think, ingenious in the way he ran his country and the way he would administer his administration. And he became famous. He became almost a legend in his own time. Now, look what happens to the guy, because this is so instructive to me. Because beginning at verse 16, it says, but when he became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly, and he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, for he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Then Azariah the priest entered after him, and with him 80 priests of the Lord, valiant men. They opposed Uzziah the king and said to him, it is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have been unfaithful and will have no honor from the Lord. But Uzziah, with a censer in his hand for burning incense, was enraged. And while he was enraged with the priest, leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priest in the house of the Lord, besides the altar of incense. Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous on his forehead. And they hurried him out of there, and he himself also hastened to get out, because the Lord had smitten him. King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and he lived in a separate house, being a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. And Jotham his son was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. Now the rest of the acts of Uzziah, first to last, the prophet Isaiah the son of Amos has written. So Uzziah slept with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the field of the grave which belonged to the kings, for they said, he is a leper. And Jotham his son became king in his place. Now, look what happens here. I think probably for every 100,000 people that can handle adversity, there's probably one, if one, that can really handle prosperity. there are people, like in the Bible, you can see Job. Job was a classic example, and you see Daniel, and you see Joseph, and you see a few other people, but most people can't handle it. I mean, we may think to ourselves, why didn't God let me win the lotto, or why can't I just get rich? Why can't I really be, you know, have an easier way of things? But I think, I tell you right now, the hardest test for any of us is prosperity, mm-hmm. is power, is fame. It really is. It really is. You look at this Uzziah. Man, God was prospering him left and right, and then what happened? He became strong. He became famous. He became a household word, and nobody could stand before him. So now he decides, well, you know, being a king isn't enough for me. I'm going to be priest too. You know, so look what he does. Verse 16, but when he became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly, and he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, for he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Now, here's the thing. God had given specific instructions that only Aaron's descendants could be priests, and the priestly tribe was, of course, the tribe of Levi. But only Aaron's descendants, his direct descendants, could go in there and offer sacrifice or go in there and burn incense before God.
John, right? John, mm-hmm. I do too. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, Azariah the priest here in 2 Chronicles 26.
Yeah.
And Azariah, son of Am.
Yeah, it gets really confusing.
Are they two different people?
Okay,
that's my question. Is Uzziah, Azariah?
Yes, they're the same people. Okay, now I said that at the beginning. I
thought you might have, but I missed it.
Okay.
The reason I asked is because I'm glad you referred to 2 Chronicles, because in 2 Kings, it says he was one of the good kings, but then on the next page it says, that God afflicted him with
leprosy. Struck him with leprosy.
And I'm so, like, yeah. Wow, the good one gets struck with leprosy. All the other ones.
Well, that's why I'm going through. My intention was to go to two chapters tonight, but I just feel, hey, in order to give this, to do this mm-hmm. justice, you've got to read 2 Chronicles to see the whole picture of what happens to this guy. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because he started out really well. He was a good king. But here's the thing. Only the descendants of Aaron could offer the incense. And so he imposed upon the priesthood. He said, oh, I'm going to be priest. Because he figured, hey, me and God are tight. So he went in there to do this. And so what do you got? You got this high priest who goes in there with 80 other priests. And they say to him, hey, you can't be in here. You're out of line, man. Get out of here. And what happens? He goes in a fit. He has a fit. And he's getting in a rage. And what happens? All of a sudden, God strikes him with leprosy right there on his forehead. And then all the priests, they're shocked. They're looking at him and go, oh. And he knows something wrong. All right, and they said, you better get out of here, man. You're struck with leprosy. Look at him now. Look how God can humble a man in an instant. Mm-hmm. All right? Because look at that verse 20. Azariah the chief priest and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous on his forehead, and they hurried him out of there, and he himself also hastened to get out because of the Lord had smitten him. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, interesting thing about this to me. Who remembers what the garment of the high priest was as far as his turban was concerned? What did he have around his turban? Anybody remember?
It's been a long.
It was what?
Scripture hanging from.
No, let me just read it. We went through Exodus. It's been a long time, so I didn't expect you to remember. But we went through Exodus in chapter 28. This is what God said that the high priest was to be wearing. He says, "You shall also make a plate of pure gold and shall engrave on it like the engravings of a seal, holy to the Lord, or holiness to the Lord. You shall fasten it on a blue cord, and it shall be on the turban, and it shall be at the front of the turban, and it shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall take away the iniquity of people," and so on and so forth. So he had the turban on. This is the high priest now. Then he has this gold band that goes across the turban, and it says on there, "Holiness unto the Lord." Now, who can't see it?
The guy wearing it.
He can't see it. This is the thing that you got to understand. I feel like the holier a person is, the less they're able to see it. In other words, let me rephrase that. It's my experience that the closer a person gets to God, the more they see themselves as a sinner. The further away a person is from God, the more they consider themselves to be, quote unquote, a good person. You follow what I'm saying here? Well, here's the thing. Look at Uzziah, or Azariah, whatever you want to call him, right? Where did God strike him with leprosy? Right there. Who couldn't see it? He couldn't see it. Everybody else could see it, right? Mm-hmm. How many people today cannot see their pride? Cannot see, you know, they say, hey, I'm good. Me and God are tight. If there's a heaven, I'm going to go there, and it doesn't matter what I do and what I believe and how I act, I'm going there. They're Uzziah. They don't see it. In the Old Testament, leprosy pointed to sin. Physical leprosy pointed to a spiritual sin in your life. Well, this is what happened to the guy. And, of course, how many people today cannot see it? This guy couldn't see it, but when he saw the expression of the priests, he didn't have to be told twice. He knew something would happen there. What happens to him? Yeah, God just puts him in his place. And that's unfortunate, isn't it? Because he started out so well, didn't he? And, you know, this is what happens to people, too. Anyway, let's go back to 1 Kings. Believe it or not, that's where we started. 1 Kings chapter 2 Kings. I'm sorry, 2 Kings. It's all running together now. Okay. All right. So we left off in verse 8.
Chapter
15 of 2 Kings. All right, verse 8. In the 38th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel and Samaria for 6 months. Now, this is a guy who reigned 6 months. And look what happened. He said, verse 9, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, as his father had done. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he had made Israel sin. Then Shalom, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him and struck him before the people and killed them and reigned in his place. Now, when we're going through this, look what's happening here. Now, there's, we're talking about the northern tribe here. Mm-hmm. And what happens, you got this king, it says here, in the 38th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam. Now, this Jeroboam is Jeroboam the second. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it can get really confusing. But he said he became king over Israel. And for how long? 6 months. Right? And it doesn't matter whether it's 55 years or if it's 6 months. You know what? It's just 15 minutes of fame. And what's the bottom line? When you're going through these, the 2 Kings and 1 Kings, but primarily 2 Kings, it's almost like you're reading king after king after king, and what's the final destination? I mean, it's the grave.
They get killed
right?
by their successor.
Right. All right? This guy only reigned 6 months. And so, like I said, it doesn't matter how long you're reigning. It doesn't matter whether you become president of the United States. It doesn't matter whether you become emperor. The bottom line is, you know what? The grave is a great leveler. It's going to reduce us all to zero, and then what? It says in the, Hebrews chapter 9, it says, hey, it's appointed unto every man to die once and then to judgment. Then we're going to have to stand before God and give an account for our lives. And, you know, look at this guy. And then in verse 9, it says, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. As his father had done, he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam. Remember, what are the sins? It's like he didn't want people to go down and worship where they were supposed to, so he just encouraged the people to do what? To worship, you know, these golden calves at Dan and Bethel. But the people wanted to hear this. Why?
Why? Would not make the trip.
Paul tells us in 2 Timothy, he says this, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing in his kingdom to do what? He says, preach the word, be ready in season and out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers and according to their own desires, and will turn their away their ears from the truth and will turn aside to myths. Now, is that what's happening to us today? I mean, are people accumulating for themselves teachers and according to their own desire? But Paul's saying what? I exhort you in season and out of season. In other words, when you feel like it, when you don't feel like it, when it's convenient, when it's not convenient. I don't say this in a boastful sense, but I've been teaching this Bible study for 35 years. And I tell you, I can hardly remember a Bible study I ever felt like, hey, it's a really convenient time. I'm really looking forward to it. I can hardly wait. You know, for me, to serve God, it's a privilege. It's an honor. It's a glory. I don't demean that. I'm just simply saying, hey, man, you can't just feel like, well, I'm not up to it. I don't feel like it. Because he's saying, preach the word when? In season, out of season. When it's convenient, when it's inconvenient. When people look, will pat you on the back for it. They spit in your face for it. They call you. I mean, call everything from Moses to the Antichrist. It doesn't matter. You know, we got to preach the word. Why? Because it's saying here that a time will come when they won't endure sound doctrines, but they will want to have their ears tickled and accumulate for themselves who? Teachers that will tell them what they want to hear. And that's what these politicians were doing, telling people what they wanted to hear. But they ended up misleading the people. And what happened? God brings judgment upon them. He brings judgment after judgment after judgment in his attempts to get men to turn back from their evil ways. Because he says here in that verse 10, he says, then Shalom, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him, and he struck him before the people and killed him and reigned in his place. Now, the rest of the acts of Zechariah, behold, they are written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Israel. This is the word of the Lord which he spoke to Jehu, saying that your sons, the fourth generation, shall sit on the throne of Israel. And it was so. Now, listen, I don't have time to go back to 2 Kings chapter 10. But in 2 Kings chapter 10, verses 30 through 31, God made a promise to Jehu because Jehu went and he executed judgment against the house of Ahab. Ahab was married to the notoriously wicked woman called Jezebel, and she led the whole nation astray, and God brought tremendous judgment upon his household, and he used Jehu to do it, to kill all of his descendants. So God said, look, because you've shown so much zeal, you know, in doing this, I'm going to allow your sons to sit upon a throne to the fourth generation. And so it was so. God kept his promise to him. And then in verse 13, it says, Shallum, son of Jabesh, became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, the king of Judah, and he reigned 1 month in Samaria. Now there's a guy who reigns 1 month. We got to look at life from the spectacles of death. We just have to, if we're going to see things clearly. Isn't this what Solomon said in Ecclesiastes? He says, hey, it's better to go into a house of mourning than to go into a house of feasting. You know what a house of mourning is? It's a funeral parlor. This is Solomon speaking, the wisest man that ever lived apart from Jesus Christ. He said, it's better that you go into a house of mourning, go into a funeral parlor, than to go to a party, go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man. We're all going to die, and the living take it to heart. What did he mean by that, the living take it to heart?
Well, when you're at a funeral, you're thinking about your own death and a serious...
Soberly thinking.
Yeah, you're measuring yourself.
When he said, but when he's saying the living take it to heart, what does he mean?
Spiritually, the
spiritually quickened person will take it to heart. Don't just make the whole application to say, well, anybody that's breathing takes it to heart. No, because not too many people, you know what I'm saying? How many people take death seriously?
Well, yeah, Christian.
Most people go through life almost like unthinking cows, just chewing their cud day after day, and they don't stop and think, you know what? What am I doing here? What is this life all about? Where did I come from? What's going to happen to me after I die? What is this life all about? How many people seriously ask those questions? I mean, I just don't see that many people take it serious. What is this all about?
You know, I think that, you know, death, besides God not wanting us to live in our sin forever, God caused death to make us realize there is something definitely wrong. You need to find out what's wrong with this. And people miss it. They just ignore the whole death thing. And God's desperately trying to say, Look at me, I'm here, I'm trying to help you.
Right. And that's why Solomon says the wise man thinks much about death. The fool only thinks of having a good time. Mm-hmm. You see, a wise person is going to stand back and take a good, hard, cold look at life. I mean, I know before I was a Christian, I mean, I used to lay in bed at night. It was after I got back from Vietnam, and I was just really confused about a lot of things. And I just laid in bed, and I didn't look at my ceiling. And think, one of these days, I'm going to be 6 feet under the frozen ground. And I'd say to myself, and if I'm conscious after that, I'm going to say, what in the hell was this all about? You know, because it just didn't make any sense to me. It just didn't, you know. At least God gave me the good grace to me to just, hey, what, fool, you know, what are you doing here? And I was asking myself that. I don't even know, I was going down all the wrong roads, getting all the wrong answers. At least I was asking. You know, I'd go to parties and I'd probably be the biggest drunk there, and I'd say to people, hey, what do you think life's all about? They'd say, well, life's whatever you want to make it. Just have a good time. Just enjoy yourself. Why be so serious? And my spirit would just scream within me, saying, man, is this it? How can people be so shallow? Is this it? It was just, it would really, really get to me. The reason I bring that up is because you look at these kings. They have it all. They've got it all. And it's here today. It's gone tomorrow. It's so fleeting. And you got to say, man, if this is it, there's got to be something more. Because if there's not life after death, if we're not made for immortality, then all of life is a bitter joke. I don't care how you cut it, and I don't care how you slice it. If the evolutionists are right, we all just evolved from some primeval slop or soup, and that's going to be the end of it. And then we're going to be thrown into a six-foot hole, and everybody's going to throw dirt on your face and go home and have a potato salad. And you say, well, what's that point? What's the point of this? There's no point, is there? He says, anyway, he says here, what did he say? That verse 13, Shallum, the son of Jabesh, became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah, and he reigned 1 month in Samaria. Then Mahanaim, son of Gadai, went up from Tirzah and came to Samaria, and he struck Shallum, the son of Jabesh, in Samaria, and he killed him and became king in his place. Look, now look what's happening too, especially in this northern kingdom. You see, there's nothing but upheaval in this northern kingdom, and there's nothing but conflict, one thing happening after another as far as God judging these people. Look what's happening in our country today. Look at all the problems that we are experiencing today. I don't care whether it's crime, I don't care whether it's our economy, I don't care whether it's our social ills. I mean, it's just all over the board. It's God trying to wake us up, and look at all the problems that these people are having. Total instability here. Because they're not seeking God, and so God's just judging him. And at verse 15, it says, now the rest of the acts of Shallum and his conspiracy which he made, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel. Then Mahanaim struck Tibshah and all who were in it, and its borders from Tirzah, because they did not open to him, and therefore he struck it and ripped up all its women who were with child. Now here you got another menace, another maniac who becomes king up there, right? This is Mahanaim, and because this certain town, this certain village, or whatever it was, they decided, hey, we don't want you to king over us. What does he do? He goes marching on his city, and he kills virtually everybody in the city, and then he rips open the pregnant woman and kills. You know, this guy was vicious. He was brutal, right? But God is allowing this to happen. Why? Because the whole northern kingdom has forsaken him. And we look at the problems we have in this country. Look at the violence that we have in this country. You know, people are killing people left and right. You see one problem after another, and I'm telling you, it's a judgment from Almighty God. In a sense, it's God's mercy. He's trying to get people to wake up, trying to get people to turn to Him and turn from their evil ways. I mean, but there's only one solution here. With our politicians, the only solution they can ever come up with for all our problems is what? What's their solution? Throw more money at it. We got problems in school. You got violence in school. You got crime on the streets. You got this problem. You got that problem. Throw more money at it. That'll fix it. That'll fix it. And they never get to the root cause of the problems.
Another government program.
Yeah, another stupid program. And God told Solomon, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. That's the only thing that's going to solve our problem. The only thing. It's not going to be more money. We could have $100 trillion with our problems, and we're still going to have 10 times the problems we got. I'm telling you, we are. Because if my people who are called by my name, does this country claim to believe in God? Does it claim to believe in His name? Every poll that's taken, I don't care whether it's a Zogby poll, a Pew poll, or you know, a Gallup poll, it always shows 90%+ in this country people believe in God, and virtually all of them are people believe in the God of the Bible. Then if all these people believe in God, why are we in such a mess? And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. You accidentally leave your purse, your wallet, your checkbook, your credit card laying out somewhere. I don't care whether it's a gas station, a department store, or wherever. Are you going to panic?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why?
Absolutely.
If 90%+ of the people in this country claim to believe in Jesus Christ, why are you going to panic?
Because it's going to be gone.
Because it's only lip service. It's only lip service. The same thing that these people were doing, giving God there, just lip service. All right? You know, if 90%+ of the people in this country were obeying God, following God, loving God, seeking God, you could misplace your wallet and you could say, oh, I'm not worried about it. Somebody call me any minute. But no, you're not going to feel that at all. You'd be a complete fool in our country today. But this is do we claim to believe in the God of the Bible? Mm-hmm. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves. Look at Azariah, Uzziah. If my people will humble themselves, you know, and pray, all right? Pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways. You tell people, turn from your wicked ways. What wicked ways? You know, what do you mean? Yeah, your wicked ways. You know, you're lying, you're cheating, you're stealing, you're conniving, all your adulteries, your abortions, your pornography. Sure, you got to turn from that. You know, well, that's nothing wrong with that. you know, go figure. Yeah.
Would you give that scripture reference again? I mean, I'm very familiar with the scripture.
Oh, it's 2 Chronicles, I think it's chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 2, right?
14.
14, okay, thank you. Thank you.
Chronicles.
Chapter 7. Yeah. Anyway, we got to move on here. And then it says here in that verse 17. It says, in the 39th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, a man named son of Gadai became king over Israel and reigned 10 years in Samaria. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did not depart all of his days from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. Again, it's redundant, isn't it? King after king after king just continues to fall into that sin. All right? Same thing today. People are worshiping God the way they want to worship God, in their own way. Even a lot of these politicians know that in my opinion, they pass all these laws and these legislations and these rules and these ordinances that are an offense to God, yet they'll go to a prayer breakfast. Go figure. And in verse 19 it says, Pul, king of Assyria, came against the land of Manaim, gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver so that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his rule. Then Manaim exacted the money from Israel, even from all the mighty men of wealth, from each man 50 shekels of silver to pay the king of Assyria. Still the king of Assyria returned and he did not remain there in the land. Look what happened here. This is pretty significant. You got the king of Assyria, you can't see it in the snap, but Assyria is way up here. He comes down there and he's just raising all kinds of ruckus down there in northern Israel. And so the king Manaim, he gives him basically $2 million worth of silver, you know, to pay him off, saying, here's some money, get lost. And so he goes back home. So what does this Manaim do? He taxes the heck, especially out of the rich, to get the money back.
Oh,
now, you tell me, what's happening to us right now? Okay, we are being taxed. 50% of our income plus goes to taxes. I don't care whether it's state tax, federal tax, local tax, so property tax, excise tax, sales tax. And what is God trying to tell people? He's hitting them in their pocketbook. Why? Because Jesus Christ said, you can't serve God and money. You can't serve two masters. You can either love one and hate the other, or cleave to one or despise the other. So God is hitting them in their pocketbook, and he's hitting this country in our pocketbook. But who's listening?
Who's listening? Not too many people. They're crying about, you know, they're up their eyeballs in red ink. And verse 21 says, now the rest of the acts of Mahanaim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles, the king of Israel? And Mahanaim slept with his fathers, and Pekah, his son, became king in his place. In verse 23, it says, in the 50th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Pekah, son of Mahanaim, became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 2 years. Now, here's a guy, he got 2 years out of it, all right? He did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. Again, God is using this as a measuring rod. Basically say, hey, man, this is my standard. You know what it boils down to is this. Right is right, even if nobody's right. And wrong is wrong, even if everybody's wrong. You know, here the old adage, everybody's doing it. Well, does that make it right? Mm-hmm. Let me repeat that. Right is right, even if nobody's right. And wrong is wrong, even if everybody's wrong. You know, in God's economy, hey, you know, he doesn't grade on a curve, and he doesn't look to the majority. And right?
Let's take a vote.
Okay, let's take a vote. You know? Okay, let's take a vote. Yeah. Put it this way. If God has not spoken it, if God has not said it, if there is no God, then it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter how you act. It really doesn't, mm-hmm. right? But he's the one that set the standard. And his standard doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, today, tomorrow. It doesn't change for any of these kings. And these kings may say, well, everybody else did it. But God's saying, hey, so what?
Yeah.
You know, so what? This is the way I'm judging you.
If the society accepts things, then people, you know, if it's accepted by society, then they think it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't make it right. Right. Okay, we got to wind this down. I think we're over time here. So, verse 25. Then Pekah, the son of Remaliah, his officer, conspired against him, and he struck him in Samaria in the castle of the king's house with Argob and Ariah. And with him were 50 men of the Gileadites, and he killed them and became king in his place. Now the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel. And you know what? Almost every time it says that, too, at the end of a king's life, it says, aren't they not written in the book of Chronicles? They want to make sure that you know everything's written down. And isn't that what Jesus said? He said this. He said, every idle word that men shall speak, they shall render an account thereof in the day of judgment. He said, everything that's done in secret will be shouted from the housetop. Everything is going to be coming to judgment. Now, for the Christian, Paul tells us in Romans, and he tells us in Corinthians, he says, we can all stand before the judgment seat of Christ as Christians. Mm-hmm. But as Christians, we're not going to stand before him as our judge. But, you know, in terms, he's not going to decide whether we're going to heaven or hell. But what he is going to judge us by is, hey, our works.
Right.
Because he tells us in Corinthians that every man's work is going to be tested. It's going to go through the fire. He says, be very careful how you build. There's only one foundation. That foundation is Jesus Christ. And if you're building with wood, hay, and stubble, it's all going to be burned up. He says, you've got to be building with gold and silver and precious stones. What I'm doing right here, it's going to pass through the fire. I can't say whether I'll get a reward or not.
Right.
Only God will decide that. But what I'm doing is going to pass through the fire. And I better be doing it with silver and gold and precious stones. What makes something precious in the sight of God when you're doing something for him?
Well, to be doing his will, to have the right motive.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not to glorify yourself, but
Jesus,
glorify
servant's heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesus said this, if you so much as give a cold glass of water in my name, even to the least of my brethren, it shall not lose its reward. In other words, we don't have to do great, grandiose things to receive a reward from God. I mean, like I've said so many times, who won last year's Indianapolis 500? Who remembers? Who won last year's Super Bowl? Who won last year's NBA? It's like, I can't remember these people. But I'll tell you what, heaven doesn't forget. If you give a cold glass of water out of love for Jesus Christ, all right, it won't lose its reward. And if we put our faith in Christ and we're building with wood, hay, and stubble, it says this, Paul says, you'll be saved by the skin of your teeth, but you won't have anything to show for it. You know, he tells us that in Corinthians. So when you look at these kings here, I think it says a lot. You know, when it says here they're written in the book of Chronicles, it's all written down. And okay, verse 27, in the 52nd year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, became king over Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 20 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. Again, you read this over and over again. That's why I went through great lengths to try to explain it, especially to new people, what he's talking about here. All right, the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. What was his sin? Setting up these golden calves. Mm-hmm. People were worshiping God the way they felt like why they wanted to. It was convenient for them. You see, God has made us in his image and likeness, all right? But what are we trying to always do as men? We try to remake his image in our image and likeness. In other words, we want him more palatable for us. You know, we want a God that's going to be more comfortable to be around. You know, that's what these guys did. In verse 29, in the days of Pekah, the king of Israel, Tiglath Pelzer, the king of Assyria, came and captured Ion and Abel-Beth-Maacah and and Kadesh and Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive into Assyria. Now look what God's doing. He's bringing the king of Assyria down now, and he's judging these people. All right, he's bringing judgment upon them because of their sins. We've given God our collective middle finger in this country. We've thrown him out of our schools and out of our courts and out of our judicial system. We've thrown him out everywhere you can think of. We don't want his name mentioned, you know what I mean? All right, except when. When we had that storm last week or whatever it was, you know, the insurance company was telling everybody, well, it's an act of God. Well, wait a minute. I thought we threw God out of every place. What are you talking about? You know, they'll use God when it's convenient. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But we throw them out every other place. So what's God doing to us? Anyway, we got to wind this out. I'm sorry, we're kind of over time. Verse 30 says, and Hosea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah and the son of Remaliah and struck him and put him to death. And he became king in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. Now the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, behold, they are written in the book of Chronicles in the kings of Israel. And in verse 32, it says, in the second year, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, became king. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, and he did according to all of his father Uzziah had done. Now, here you got a king, Jotham. He's the son of Uzziah, the one who had leprosy, right? But look at his mother here. He had a good father, but his father just blew it. But I think, you know, that when he mentioned the mother here, I think there's a suggestion there that the mother had a very godly influence upon this man's life, and it made a real difference. And I'm telling you, parents make all the difference in the world when it comes to, you know, their children's spirituality. It's just no getting around it. You know, look at how many parents today have abdicated their responsibility as the spiritual head, especially fathers. A man is the spiritual head of his household. God's going to hold him responsible for the spiritual condition of his children and his family. That's all there is to it. And look, we got in some of these inner cities, you got 70-80% of the kids don't even have a father. All right? We've got so many people today, they just feel like, well, you know, who needs a father, you know? And I'm telling you, hey, you know what? As far as God's concerned, his design is, you know, you need a father and you need a mother, and you need to raise their children up in the love and knowledge and fear of God. Right? And they're going to have to account to God for the spiritual condition of their children.
John, yeah. He only mentions the mother's name when it's a good king, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, usually that's the case, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in verse 35, only the high... Now, look, here we go with the high places again. Only the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrifice and burn incense on the high places. He built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. Look at the high places. The high places, the people felt like, well, we're worshiping the God of heaven, right? But they're doing it in their own way. And that's why I read out of Corinthians where Paul says, hey, man, there can be a different gospel, a different Jesus, a different spirit. You see what I'm saying? That's why we need discernment. Then he said, verse 36, now the rest of the acts of Jotham and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? In those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. And Jotham slept with his fathers, and he was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father, and Ahaz, his son, became king in his place. Now, I'm going to see who's listening. I'm going to see who's paying attention. You read about this Jotham. He's a good king. And if he's a good king, why does it say over there in verse 37, in those days the Lord began to send Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah? If Jotham's a good king, why is Judah being plagued with enemies?
Not removing.
There it is. The guy listened. Okay, verse 35. That's what God was doing. Because these people were worshiping God in their own way, all right, rather than the place that God had chosen. They figure, well, there's a hill, there's a mountain, and we worship God this way. Because God knew, when you start worshiping him on every other hill or any place you choose, then what happens is that you're going to end up inculcating a lot of the pagan practices. Because that's why when I read in Deuteronomy chapter 12, it said that the heathen, the pagan, the Canaanites, were worshiping on every high place and every mountain, and their form of worship was pagan worship. They were worshiping the sun, the moon, the stars. They were worshiping all kinds of deities and demons. And they, you know, a lot of their worship services inculcated a lot of immoral practices and whatnot.
And doesn't God have every right for to set the terms of how we approach them? You know, back in way back in Genesis, where Cain gave a sacrifice, and then Abel, his brother, gave a sacrifice. God had rejected Cain's sacrifice because he did it his own way, did the way he wanted.
Good.
Clear because, back in the beginning.
Because here's the thing, that's a very good point. Because we are told in Jude that certain people have gone the way of Cain. Now you tell me, what's the way of Cain?
Their own way.
Yeah, people say, well, he was a murderer. That's not the way of Cain. The way of Cain was this. Cain felt like, okay, I'm giving God the best of my produce. God should be happy with this. Mm-hmm. But God made it abundantly clear through Adam and Eve that it had to be an animal sacrifice. How did God make that abundantly clear to them?
The clothing.
There. Because they were naked, they were not ashamed, but then when they sinned, they had this overwhelming sense of shame, and God said to Adam, where are you? He says, well, I'm hiding. He said, why are you hiding? He says, because I'm naked. He said, who told you you're naked? He said, did you eat that fruit? He said, yeah, I did. He said, well, okay. What do you do? God, it says, made clothing for them out of animal skins. Now, believe me, you're not going to get animal skins off an animal without killing that animal. So that was a substitute. That was a substitute right. that pointed to Christ. Mm-hmm. That animal that was killed, that was the first sacrifice pointing to Jesus Christ. And then Abel picked that up from his parents and he figured the only way I'm going to be right with God is through a blood sacrifice. Because the Bible says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. But Cain, he probably felt like, well, I don't want to kill an animal. Well, that's cruel. Heck with that. I'm going to give God this. God didn't accept it. You know, he was too squeamish to kill an animal, but he ended up killing his brother. That's the way it came, right? But just in closing note here. Okay, Jesus set the record straight when God chose that particular place and people weren't obeying him. When Jesus was in Samaria, you know, he met that woman at the well. And then he says, they got in that conversation and the woman says to him, well, you Jews worship down there in Jerusalem. We worship over here in Mount Gerizim. Who's right? And Jesus said the Jews are right. That's where they're supposed to worship. But he says there's coming a day when God is going to seek those who worship him in spirit and in truth. It's not going to matter what place. We got to worship him in our spirit and truth. In other words, a lot of people say they worship God, but they're not worshiping him in truth. It's not the one true God. Like I said, these cults or any other, all these other people, right? But it's got to be in spirit. And spirit means you are worshiping God from your heart.
Right?
It's like what God said through Isaiah. These people worship me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. You're worshiping God in spirit, you're worshiping him from your heart, and you're worshiping in truth. The two go hand in hand. If you don't have the truth, then you can't have, you know, you're worshiping the wrong God. Anyway, anybody have anything I want to add or share what we read?
No,